Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the announcement of a new pope, Cardinal Jorge Mario Bergoglio of Argentina, and speak with Alexander Stille, professor of international journalism at Columbia University and author of The Sack of Rome, How a Beautiful European Country with a Fabled History and a Storied Culture Was Taken Over by a Man Named Silvio Berlusconi. We will discuss the dual dysfunction of a scandal-plagued Vatican under a new Pope for the Poor, Francis, and an Italian government in a state of political paralysis. Then we'll look into the deadly legacy of the Fukushima meltdown 2 years ago in terms of the tens of thousands of U.S. military personnel and their dependents who were exposed to radiation, with some sailors from the USS Ronald Reagan suffering chronic and severe illness that has led them to sue TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power Company. Roger Witherspoon, a 40-year veteran reporter who now blogs at energymatters.com, joins us to discuss how the NRC and the Navy were lied to by Japanese authorities while sailors on a rescue mission were breathing in radioactive air and the USS Ronald Reagan was sucking in radioactive ocean water into its desalinization system for the crew's drinking and bathing. Then finally, we will speak with Mark Lofgren, a veteran House and Senate staffer and author of The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy and Democrats Became Useless and the Middle Class Got Shafted. We will discuss meetings going on among Democratic senators about what to do about the Republicans' routine use of the filibuster to block Obama's judicial and executive branch nominees following a reform deal Harry Reid made with Mitch McConnell over the objections of younger Democratic senators that has blown up in the majority leaders' face. Joining us now is Alexander Stille, who is the San Paolo Professor of International Journalism at Columbia University. He's the author of Benevolence and Betrayal, Five Italian Jewish Families Under Fascism, Excellent Cadavers, The Mafia and the Death of the First Italian Republic, The Future of the Past and the Sack of Rome, How a Beautiful European Country with a Fabled History and a Storied Culture Was Taken Over by a Man Named Silvio Berlusconi. Welcome to Background Briefing, Alexander Stille.
Thanks for having me.
And it seems to me that we have dual dysfunction in Italy at the moment with the Vatican. Of course, it's getting an enormous amount of free publicity. The scandal-plagued church is dominating the headlines. Breathlessly, the world reporters are talking about what color smoke is coming out, and they're interviewing anybody with a clerical collar they can find in St. Peter's Square. But there's obviously a dark side to the Catholic Church. And there's certainly a dysfunctional side to the government now with the rejectionist party doing so well of the comedian Pepe Grillo. So do you see this as a sort of double whammy?
Well, it is. I mean, the problems of the Catholic Church will be resolved. I mean, the leadership void will be solved rather quickly. White smoke has emerged from the Sistine Chapel, and a new pope will be announced very soon. So there will be somebody governing the Catholic Church. There's been this strange period of interregnum after the resignation of Pope Benedict. The problem in the Italian government will be much harder to solve, but that doesn't mean the Catholic Church doesn't have its long-term problems as well. In the case of the Italian government, it may seem crazier than it actually is, in the sense that what you have at the moment is a stalemate whose solution is very hard to predict. This last election produced three large parties sharing nearly 80% of the vote, and no one of them able to govern by itself. And so you have a kind of standoff. You have the main center left party, the Democratic Party, getting about 30% of the vote, but less than it hoped, and without a firm majority. You had Beppe Grillo's protest movement, which resists the definition of party, getting about 26%, the largest single party, and a coalition of center-right parties led by former Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi with about 29%. And as I said, alliances between any of these three parties are almost impossible to imagine. And so we have a situation of of real stalemate. But to go back to my main point is that it's not as crazy as it might appear to an American viewer. It's easy when you live thousands of miles away from Italy to say, you know, oh, those crazy Italians, 60 governments in 60 years, how can they run a country this way? But their system is different than ours, and it produces different kinds of results. It's a parliamentary system in which the prime minister depends on a majority in parliament, and they vote proportionally, which means that if a party gets 10% of the vote, it gets a proportionate amount of the seats in parliament. It means that protest movements that start at the margins of society can make it into parliament. If you think of the fact that somebody like Ross Perot came out of nowhere and got 19% of the vote in 1992, even though the people who voted for him knew that he wasn't going to win and that they were going to get zero members of Congress as a result of their vote. You can imagine if the Perot voters had thought, hey, we can elect 19% of the people in Parliament and push and negotiate with one of the larger parties in order to promote our agenda, those kinds of third parties would be much more popular. You can imagine that the Tea Party or the Occupy Wall Street movement in this country would have run separately and might have been in a position to greatly condition either Republican Party or the Democratic Party with a strong turnout. So the system works differently and produces these results, which seem very odd to outsiders, but that make more sense when you understand the system. In some ways, the Grillo movement is a little bit like a kind of cross between Occupy Wall Street and the Tea Party movement. It is an anti-government movement that is fed up with all kinds of things that haven't been going well in Italy, and channel that kind of popular anger against government, against a system that seems to be unfair, a system that works unequally, a government that wastes a lot of money and favors insiders over the average citizen, and so forth. So the feelings that these movements generate are actually should be quite familiar to Americans watching it. The problem is that precisely because of this different system, it then becomes difficult to see how Italy's going to get out of this stalemate, because the Beppe Grillo movement, the five-star movement as it's called, is determined not to act like a traditional political party. If this were a normal political party, they would begin negotiating with one of the two other main groups and say, okay, we'll give you support for a government, but we want you to agree to the following terms. We want you to agree to push legislation that does X, Y, and Z. We'd like the Ministry of Justice or the Ministry of the Economy or something like that. That's the way normal politics works. These people are based on the idea that normal politics is completely broken, and therefore any kind of negotiation, any kind of traditional coalition making is just participating in a system that is bankrupt in their view. And so it becomes very difficult. There's no obvious negotiation out. What they actually are secretly hoping is that the main center-left party will negotiate with Berlusconi and with Mario Monti, who was the kind of technocrat prime minister after Berlusconi resigned in December of 2011, because they want, in some ways, well, since they don't have a majority yet, they want the old parties to continue behaving like the old parties so that they can then come back in elections and do even better. So they would like the party that is the sort of main reform party, the center-left party, the Democratic Party, to discredit itself by making the old kind of deals and compromises that it's been used to making, which will fuel the anti-government anger and lead to an even better result in future elections. Beppe Grillo has said very simply, we're not interested in compromises. We want 100% of the parliament because we want to actually change the entire system. He has an idea in mind which is very interesting, if hard to imagine, of kind of installing direct democracy. The thing that is kind of interesting about this movement is that it is a political movement that was born on the Internet. And interestingly, they learned from American models. They studied the Howard Dean campaign of 2004, which was very successful in organizing younger people using the internet, and said, "What if we have a party that's completely on the internet? In fact, what if we forbid any of our candidates from even appearing on television? Because television is part of the past, the internet is the future, and we are an internet party."
Sure, and television's controlled by Berlusconi.
Controlled by Berlusconi and by the Italian state and all the rest of that. So, in that sense, it represents something very interesting, although this kind of direct democracy also has its troubling sides to it. How do you actually agree on anything? Is everything, if people said we don't want to pay taxes and we also want free government services, what do you do? Those two things are incompatible. And there's also a kind of problem of internal democracy with this movement, because on the one hand, it's this internet party where everyone gets to decide, but at the same time, it's headed by this rather strange, volatile, somewhat autocratic former comedian who actually decides a great deal by himself. So it's an interesting phenomenon worth studying.
And, of course, the white smoke has come out of the Sistine Chapel. There is a new pope. I imagine we'll know quite soon who that is. But to my mind, Alexander Stieler, it doesn't matter, because the pool of 115 cardinals has been chosen by this very conservative pope
and his predecessor.
And his predecessor, who was equally conservative. So what's the big deal?
Well, I think that some skepticism is in order. I think that American Catholics, who tend to be more liberal than the two recent popes, American Catholics are quite out of step doctrinally with the papacy in recent years. They disagree with the papacy on issues like divorce, contraception, divorce people participating in communion, homosexuality, the ordination of women, married priesthood, and so forth. These kind of sexual morality issues that the Vatican has chosen to make so important. And as you say, it's very unlikely that you're going to see significant change on those issues, because the last two popes have made them a sort of litmus test for advancement in the church, and the people who've reached the rank of cardinal are unlikely to be, closet dissidents on those kinds of issues. I think at the same time, the leaders of the church are not unaware that they have a big problem, that their leadership, which is composed mostly of elderly white men from Europe, the U.S., in a church that is increasingly located in South America, Central America, Africa, Asia, most of whose parishioners are female and not male, in which the celibate priesthood is dwindling in number, and they're having trouble filling parishes with ordained priests. They know that they have a problem, and that there is a kind of disconnect between the people governing the church and the ordinary people in the pews. And so they're going to try to make some effort to address that, but I do fear that it will be mostly a kind of window dressing issue. We don't know who they've chosen as a pope, but I think they will try to, choose somebody who represents at least the impression of change, perhaps whether through geography, choosing somebody who is not Italian or possibly not from Europe, or through an interesting biography of somebody who has shown an ability to listen and deal with parishioners in a way that conveys a message of openness, but it leaves unaddressed these larger problems that you've raised about a lack of inner democracy in the church, of being out of touch with the views of many parishioners. But the Catholic Church has a big problem, because while there are many Catholics who feel out of touch with Catholic doctrine, there are also the majority of Catholics who actually attend church on a regular basis tend to be more traditional and are likely to react very badly should the church change policy on these critical issues. So the church, if it goes too far, could face a major schism and all kinds of internal divisions, which would be very difficult for it. So they have a tough road ahead for them of needing to kind of balance the desire for change and the pressure from change from below, but at the same time, a lot of resistance, not only at the leadership level, but also among many loyal Catholics to changes who identify Catholicism with tradition with a capital T, as Archbishop Dolan of New York put it the other day. And so even those traditions are not actually from the gospel, but are medieval traditions that grew up in the Catholic Church. They're deeply held within that faith and within that community.
Well, just in closing, Alexander Stiller, back to the political dysfunction in Italy. It is a European-wide phenomenon, surely, the politics of rejection. You've got Syriza in Greece. You've got, I think, 40% unemployment amongst the young in Italy, 55% unemployment amongst the young in Spain. Isn't there something happening here with these growth of the pirate parties and the Pepe Grillo-type parties? Isn't this something that's going to grow until Europeans get their financial house in order, which doesn't look like it's going to happen soon?
I mean, I think you're absolutely right that this period of austerity and also the difficulty among the weaker economies of Europe of adjusting to life under the euro has created space for protest movements. I mean, when you consider that, you know, when you consider that unemployment in France is 25%, that's levels that the United States reached only at the depths of the Great Depression. These are really, really serious problems. Greece has never been, since World War II, I think, in such a dire economic condition. And so those are problems that have opened space for protest movements. And there is a sense, you know, what's happened with the euro is that it has made national governments weaker than ever before, and anger against them greater than ever before, because in previous eras in a country like Italy, the central government could just devalue the currency, the lira, and that would immediately make Italian products more competitive and make the economy, give the economy a jolt. In the euro system, they can't do that, and that's one of the reasons why, instead they're under pressure to better their balance sheets and tighten the belt. And that, of course, creates popular resistance and unhappiness.
Well, Alexander Stiller, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Okay. Thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Be well.
Again, I've been speaking with Alexander Stiller, who is a San Paolo Professor of International Journalism at Columbia University. He's the author of Benevolence and Betrayal, Five Italian Jewish Families Under Fascism, Excellent Cadavers, The Mafia and the Death of the First Italian Republic, The Future of the Past, and most recently, The Sack of Rome, How a Beautiful European Country with a Fabled History and a Storied Culture Was Taken Over by a Man Named Silvio Berlusconi. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about how sailors from the USS Ronald Reagan were exposed to radiation and lied to by Japanese authorities.
Changes. Don't tell them to blow up on all of it.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Roger Witherspoon, who has spent more than 40 years working for Time, Newsweek, Fortune, Essence, Black Enterprise, The Economist, the U.S. Black Engineer, and IT, writing extensively on state and national politics, foreign affairs, finance, defense, civil rights, constitutional law, health and environment and energy. He's the founder of the Association of Black Journalists, which grew into the present National Association of Black Journalists, and is a member of the Society of Environmental Journalists. He blogs at energymatters.com. Welcome to Background Briefing, Roger Witherspoon.
Thank you very much.
And you've been following the Fukushima meltdown 2 years later, and in particular, the fate of the sailors aboard the USS Ronald Reagan, the big aircraft carrier that docked right next to where these nuclear reactors melted down, I think within a mile.
They were offshore as close as a mile and a half to 2 miles. They were in and out of that region for about 80 days.
So you've spoken to a lot of the sailors. Surely the alarm bells were going off. I mean, they have radiological equipment aboard these ships.
Well, the surprising thing is that they didn't. The nuclear power plant that propels the aircraft carrier is literally at the bottom of the ship. It is quite well sealed, and there are detection systems in the bottom of the ship to make sure that no radiation seeps out and contaminates the rest of the ship. And the sailors who actually work in the power system all wear dosimeters. But the assumption was that any radiological danger would come from a problem at the bottom of the ship, not from the air and not from the water. So you didn't have detection systems and sailors wearing dosimeters elsewhere on the ship, particularly on the surface. And they get their water literally from the ocean. They have their own desalinization plant. And it didn't occur to them to put sensors in there and test the water. So as a result, they got contaminated two ways. One, from being in proximity to Fukushima, where they were subject to a variety of contaminants that were airborne, but also since there was no power at Fukushima, the Japanese resorted to pouring seawater through the top of Units 1 through 4, particularly the spent fuel pool in Unit 4, and having it run out the bottom, as opposed to the normal way where you put water in and you simply circulate it. And so when it ran out the bottom, it went back into the sea. And as a result, they wound up contaminating the ship by sucking water into both hose off the deck and for their own drinking water and cooking and all other purposes. And they wound up contaminating the entire ship.
But surely these ships, Roger Witherspoon, have sensors for radiation in the air, at least, wouldn't they?
They did when they put them up, but they don't routinely have them. It didn't occur to them that there would be radiation in the environment.
Even though, don't they follow the news? Don't they know that these reactors are melting down?
When they first got there, they didn't. And one of the things that happens when you're on an operation at sea is they cut off internet access to the land. So the crew is actually blind to what's going on. So the kind of discussion that was regularly going on here, pictures of the plants blowing up, they didn't have that.
But does that extend to the officers? I'm talking about the officers in charge. They have a responsibility for the lives of those serving under them.
Looking at the traffic, both the NRC's operations center conference calls, which are a matter of public record, as well as some of the other discussions, which are publicly accessible, the short answer is no. The Navy would tell the NRC, for example, at Yokosuka Air Base, Naval Air Base, which was 188 miles south of Fukushima, they contacted the NRC and said, we're getting these readings at such and such a rate per hour. And the NRC guy said, that's not possible because according to the Japanese government and TEPCO, the only releases are X, and you couldn't get it back there. So NRC Chairman Jasko said, well, can we figure this backwards? And so as they did that, they said, well, the only way that that amount of radiation could be recorded 188 miles south in this period of time is if, in fact, there's no reactor, that it's already broken and breached, which in reality it had been, but they'd been lied to. And so the NRC wound up calculating backwards, and the NRC wasn't really sure of its own data and called in Exelon, the nation's largest fleet operator, and said, can you loan us one of your people and run these numbers and see if we've done it correctly. And Exelon got back to them and said, we get the same thing you do.
So, meanwhile, there's nobody aboard the USS Ronald Reagan, which is a mile and a half away from these nuclear power plants that are melting down and spewing radiation into the air. And you would have wondered whether somebody would have noticed those explosions because they were pretty massive. They're not getting reading from their radiological equipment?
They didn't initially set up detection systems at all. And then finally, when they did and start setting up decontamination and detection centers around the ship, they initially didn't tell the sailors and the staff what they were doing, because they'd assured them that, hey, there are rumors that there's radiation out there, but we assure you that there isn't. And then as two of the navigators that I talked to, one of them, Maurice Ennis, the navigators are also in charge of the flags at the very top of the ship, and that's how they signal the rest of the fleet. An aircraft carrier doesn't travel by itself. There's a whole flotilla that goes with it. And so he had to collect the American flag on the top, and he folded it up, put it under his arm, walked around, and finally put it away. And as he walked past one of these newly set up decontamination and detection centers, all the alarms went off. And they ordered everybody to get away from him, don't touch anybody, stand back, had him strip, and had him scrub right there with this very abrasive soap that they use for cleaning the hull of the ship, which basically is like liquid sandpaper and takes off a layer of skin.
Roger, it was the flag that he was carrying, was it, that was...
Correct. Yeah. It had been flying at the highest point of the ship throughout all of this, and it didn't occur to anybody, that being a nice porous material, that it would absorb anything in the air. You have to also keep in mind that while the Navy and the NRC was focusing on particulates like cesium or iodine that could be deposited on a surface, they completely ignored things like noble gases, which blow over and don't deposit, but you can very well inhale them. And at that range, it is likely that many of the sailors did.
Again, I'm speaking with...
They had problems on land, of course, because there are 63 bases, and some of the naval bases nearby, particularly at Tsugi, which had helicopter fleets, were pressed into this rescue operation. And so the mechanics there were handling highly contaminated material every day. The helicopters would come back, and one of the people I interviewed, the head mechanic, he also became the chief hazmat guy, named Michael Seaborn, who's based in California. They would have to scan the helicopters as they returned. And basically, if you have a reading over 1,000 counts per minute on their Geiger counters, you have to wear a hazmat suit. And the helicopters would come back from a single trip with their radiators having readings of over 60,000. And so they would have to take the radiators out and put new ones in. Well, they're handling this stuff on a daily basis. And wound up getting contaminated themselves as a result.
Is this now, I want to get on to, I know you've talked to a lot of these sailors aboard the USS Ronald Reagan, Roger, but I'm interested in just following through on what you've been telling us so far. Is this a case of just military stupidity? I mean, you know, anybody that's served in the military knows that it's kind of a brain-dead organization at times. Is this what you're telling us?
In any system, you rely on the experts, and here the experts were the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, and there were certain myths in the nuclear industry that, frankly, got exposed in Fukushima. And some of them pertain to your people out there in California. One is the myth of the plume, that radiation travels in this tightly bound plume. And if you've ever attended a hearing dealing with the evacuation plans for a reactor in your region, the plans call for evacuating the neighborhoods directly in the path of this so-called plume. And the theory is that radiation is tightly bound. It goes in a straight line. The industry generally uses the phrase that it's a plume, just like water coming out of your garden hose, and it stays together, and you can identify it, and as long as you stick to one side or the other, you're fine. And all of the civilian evacuation plans rely on that. All of them are false, because there's no such thing as a damn plume. It actually comes out. It comes out as a gas, and it goes all over, wherever the wind blows. There is no plume. But the Navy was advised by the NRC that if you can avoid the plume, you're fine. And so they actually tried doing that, what they thought was a plume, and they couldn't, because it was basically a cloud that was all around and blew wherever the wind blew. And they were told to draw sort of a triangle coming out of Fukushima, draw a line straight out 50 miles, and then if you make a T, the top of it would be 25 miles on either side of this line, and make a triangle going back to Fukushima. And as long as you avoided this plume triangle, you're fine. Well, that's fictitious. If you look at my website, actually, the story that I wrote on that, I have copies of two maps. One is the projected path of the plume, which is fairly narrow, and if you can see that, then you can avoid it. And the other was an actual map of where the radiation went, which was all over the place.
Now, who generated that map, and why was that information not...
That was by the Japanese government.
Right.
That was by the Japanese government in their analysis of Fukushima afterwards.
I see. So that was too late for anybody to
act. Oh, yeah.
On.
And looking back, it's, well, I guess we were wrong.
So that gets to the heart of the matter here in terms of liability, Roger Witherspoon, and that is that the Navy apparently got all of the sailors to sign a waiver, basically signing away their rights. And those sailors who have been contaminated on the USS Ronald Reagan, they're suing TEPCO, aren't they? The Tokyo Electric
Power. Well, when you join the military, remember, it's a volunteer military. When you join the military, you, among other things, sign away the right to sue the military. And that's not unreasonable, since by definition, they're going to send you into dangerous areas. The other side of that, of course, is the expectation that if you get hurt, the military will take care of you. And here is where there's been a breach of faith, if you will. They are suing TEPCO because, frankly, TEPCO lied. And everybody I talked to, including a 22-year-old woman who's just had her second operation for an incurable brain cancer, she said the Navy did the best they could. They just didn't know, and the information they got was wrong, and the information they got came from TEPCO.
And the NRC?
Well, the NRC was getting a lot of its information from the Japanese government, and then once they finally realized you couldn't trust the Japanese government and TEPCO, they tried extrapolating on their own. But they did have certain myths that they operated with, which were wrong.
Right.
But it was TEPCO that, and if TEPCO had been honest in the beginning, there would have been a lot more caution all over. But TEPCO was saying there wasn't radiation when there was, or that the reactors were intact when they were not.
Well, but Roger, what this makes me think immediately is that if they were lying to the U.S. Navy, who are offshore, they must have been lying to every Japanese town in that neighborhood.
Oh, they did. They lied to everybody. The Japanese people are quite furious at how they've been contaminated and lied to by TEPCO and their government. But the problem that the sailors have now is that at the insistence of apparently Bernie Sanders, the Navy set up a registry, Tomodachi Medical Registry, for 70,000 members of the military and their family who were exposed. And
70,000?
There were 70,000 Americans at 63 bases and their families. And then that includes about 12,000 who were in the Reagan strike force, 5,500 just on the aircraft carrier, and then you've got another 10 ships. There were 70,000
Wow.
Americans who were contaminated from Fukushima. And, in fact, women and children, dependents, rather, and children were evacuated from Yokosuka, which is 180 miles south, and evacuated to Guam for a while. But they set up this registry, and it took 2 years to do that and compile all of the medical records. And then this January, and they finished that in December. And you need a registry to and monitor everybody for a number of years to determine if patterns of illness show up that you can then attribute to a particular cause. But in January, the Navy decided, or rather the Defense Department decided, well, we don't think there was enough radiation out there in average to hurt anybody, and therefore we're killing the registry, and so they're not going to use it. And the problem with that, of course, is if you don't gather the information, then of course you're not going to know. And the Navy now is then turning down claims by saying we have no evidence that you were that your current problem was caused by your exposure. Mm-hmm. And so you have people with cysts, you have people with liver problems, you have people with lung problems, and they're saying, you know, I was healthy before that. And the Navy is saying, nope, we have no evidence that you that this was caused by your exposure to radiation, because in theory, you didn't have enough.
Well, just in the last minute, Roger Witherspoon, you mentioned that you've interviewed the navigators who were exposed, and they are suing TEPCO, are they not? And
yes.
Haven't they exhibited a lot of problems?
Yes, both of them have. Maurice Ennis has appeared to be gross, both on his face and elsewhere. Some of his hair is falling out, and he's gotten just weaker. I mean, he's got at 6'2", and used to play football in college. But he has trouble pushing me around, and trust me, that's not really taking a lot of work. Miss Plim has suddenly developed what are called gynecological problems, and that instead of having a normal menstrual cycle, she will suddenly hemorrhage to the extent that she's in the emergency room needing a blood transfusion.
Oh, this is so dreadful. And
she's developed asthma, which she's never had. I mean, these are pretty healthy young people.
Sure.
And the problem you have with that is, you know, she goes to claim with the Navy, and they say, well, you know, we have no record of you having this, so you must have developed this afterwards. Since the Navy took no comprehensive medical history of any of the 70,000 when they compiled this registry. Instead, all they did was collect the back medical records of folks. And so when you now report something, they treat it as if, oh, it's brand new, it happened after you left the service, it's not our problem, claim denied. And so you have all of these veterans who are suddenly on their own with no insurance, no coverage, and the Navy pretends it didn't own it.
Well, Roger Witherspoon, I thank you for the work that you're doing and bringing this information to the public, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Roger Witherspoon, who has spent more than 40 years working for Time, Newsweek, Fortune, Essence, Black Enterprise, The Economist, and the U.S. Black Engineer in IT, writing extensively on state and national politics, foreign affairs, defense, health, the environment, and energy. He is the founder of the Association of Black Journalists, which grew into the present National Association of Black Journalists, and a member of the Society of Environmental Journalists. He blogs at energymatters.com. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about meetings going on amongst Democratic senators about how Harry Reid got snookered by Mitch McConnell and what they can do about the filibuster.
But the Adams here, in spite of hysteria, it flourishes in Utah as well as Siberia. And whether you're a black, white, red, or brown, the question is this when you boil it down. To be or not to be, that's the question. The answer to it all ain't military datum, like who gets there firstest with the mostest atoms. No, the people of the world must decide their fate. They gotta get together or disintegrate. A whole list truth to be self-evident that all men may be cremated equal.
Baby.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mike Lofgren, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on TARP, Hurricane Katrina disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He's the author of the new book, The Party is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mike Lofgren.
Nice to be here.
And the senators are meeting, apparently, the Democratic Senate leaders are meeting to discuss ways to overcome or counter Republican obstruction of particularly Barack Obama's judicial nominees. Recently, Caitlin Halligan, her nomination to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit, which is a key court that feeds both cases to the Supreme Court and justices to the Supreme Court. She was stymied for a second time by a silent filibuster. And of course, we also witnessed a real filibuster recently with Rand Paul. So there's a bit of history here, Mike, in as much as apparently the younger senators on the Democratic side wanted some serious filibuster reform. And Harry Reid met with Mitch McConnell and came up with some kind of compromise reform. But it looks like the Democrats got taken. They got hosed, didn't they?
Well, that's exactly what it appears to be. Now, Senator Merkley of Oregon was one of the younger senators who were working very hard on real filibuster reform, and he kind of got brushed aside when Senator Reid made that deal with Senator McConnell. And one of the reasons, and it's interesting to note, that Tom Harkin, the senior Democratic senator from Iowa, announced that he would be retiring at the end of his term, is he wanted filibuster reform, and he didn't want to hang around forever in an institution where nothing could get done.
Well, the price, though, that the Democrats pay and that the White House pays and is pretty profound. If it's that easy to do a silent filibuster where you just basically say you're going to filibuster without actually having to put skin in the game, and if they can do it repeatedly, particularly on this key court where there are four vacancies, one of which goes back to the Chief Justice John Roberts leaving in 2005, there is a Republican strategy there involved in keeping that court dominated by Republicans. Because the amazing thing is that that court recently ruled that Obama's only means to get around Senate filibusters was recess appointments, and now they've invalidated his recess appointments, and that's going to go to the Supreme Court. So it's an amazing deal for the Republicans to be able to completely stymie the White House without any skin in the game.
Yes, it's a very well-articulated strategy. But people have to understand that it's sort of the strategy that dare not speak its name in public. And the public should also understand that there's filibusters and there's filibusters. I have no objection to some senator getting up a la Mr. Smith goes to Washington and holding the floor for as long as he can to talk about some issue that's troubling him, whether it be Rand Paul on the Republican side or Bernie Sanders on the Democratic side.
Well, he's an independent,
but they
by the
cannot
way.
Explain their strategy to the public, so they just file a motion and very quietly, and nothing happens as a result. And people should understand this is a strategy to invalidate the results of popular elections. I think we had a referendum on the whole issue, for instance, of Dodd-Frank, whether banks should be regulated. I don't think Dodd-Frank went nearly far enough, but such provisions as are in it that help rein in Wall Street, Republicans are preventing from being implemented by simply filibustering nominees to positions like the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. Richard Cordray's been waiting forever for that position.
Right. Well,
now,
well Mike,
we decided in the election that we were not going to have laissez-faire a la Mitt Romney. The public stuck with Mr. Obama, who signed the legislation. He signed Dodd-Frank. So one would think, give him the benefit of the doubt. And if the nominee is not tainted ethically or not otherwise disqualified, Mr. Obama's choice should be respected.
Well, I was going to say that in the hearings that took place on Tuesday before the Senate Banking Committee, Senator Warren, Elizabeth Warren, she, rather than waste her time interviewing the witness, Cordray, who's testified on numerous occasions, she turned her ire on her Republican colleagues and basically laid it on the line that you guys are just obstructing. This is just filibuster. And frankly, you're working for the big banks at the expense of ordinary consumers who have been ripped off on their mortgages, their credit cards, and their student loans.
Well, she's one of the rare cases where filibustering a nominee meant the filibusters didn't get quite what they bargained for. Now they have to deal with her as an equal.
Well, she's, why aren't there more Democrats like her? Because the whole point is, and it goes back to your book, Mike Lofgren, The Party is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. Now, they are being useless. They look pathetic, and so does Harry Reid, for making this worthless deal with Mitch McConnell and then having McConnell slap him in the face no sooner than the ink is dry. And we know what their strategy is, and we know that the younger Democratic senators are saying we've got to get real here, but I take it the reason why Harry Reid and the company are nervous about what they call the nuclear option, which is demanding you either stand and deliver in terms of a filibuster, or we have just majority rule, that's going to come back to bite them if the Republicans take over. So walk us through that logic.
Well, he got, he being Reid, not only got snookered by his opponents, the Republicans, but he's angered a lot of Democrats in the process. Now, I can imagine he and a number of the other senior Democrats, particularly ones in swing states, know that there are quite a number of Democratic Senate seats up in 2014, a lot more than Republican seats, and last election of a two-term president typically is not very favorable for the president's party in Congress. So it is possible that Republicans could win a net six seats and take control, and they are terrified of setting a precedent with the nuclear option and simply doing away with the filibuster period. So, it is a little ironic considering that when Republicans take over in a legislature, as we've seen in many state legislatures, they have no hesitation whatever in passing the most far-reaching proposals without any regard to, well, what will the other side do to us if we lose control? Once they get control, they do everything they can. They move heaven and earth to pass their agenda. As you can see, Democrats are much more split-minded because they have a theoretically progressive agenda, many of them, but they're also beholden to the same moneyed interests that fund the Republicans. And this makes them kind of schizophrenic.
So what is the alternative then between the nuclear option that could come back to bite the Democrats and this useless deal that Harry Reid made with Mitch McConnell that Mitch McConnell has slapped him in the face with?
I think it should be incumbent on the party or the individuals who are filibustering to hold the floor. And I think holds on nominations, be they executive or judicial, should not be anonymous. If we're a democracy, things should be transparent. That would give the minority certainly adequate protection, but it would not allow them to ignore the results of elections, and essentially, rather than having a majoritarian body, the way the House of Representatives has always been set up to be, it's no longer a body involved in consensus. It's a minoritarian body where the minority gets its way. It can't pass legislation, but it can kill every single initiative of the majority if it cares to.
Well, we've had that system here in the state of California for decades, where the minority party, the Republicans, essentially ruled in Sacramento through the minority by the requirements of these supermajorities, these two-thirds majorities, which is the same as the filibuster. And my understanding is the roots of that supermajority go back to Jim Crow and slavery in the South.
Right. We have to look at the Senate as an institution that's almost designed for that. They pride themselves as the world's greatest deliberative body and so forth. My rather cynical appraisal of that would be the same as Winston Churchill when he became First Lord of the Admiralty. I think it was in 1911 or something like that. And he took over the Royal Navy and wanted to reform it. And, of course, the admirals were aghast. They talked about the traditions of the Royal Navy. And he said, the traditions of the Royal Navy are rum, sodomy, and the lash. If you look at the traditions of the Senate, it's slavery, Jim Crow, and McCarthyism. Not a very good trio. For most of its history, it has been involved in upholding either slavery or Jim Crow. It suffered its last gasp, you know, within living memory. It needs reform.
So is the reform then, and I don't understand why Harry Reid didn't listen to the junior Democratic senators, if they were proposing what you're suggesting, which is that you've got to put skin in the game with these filibusters, you've got to be able to stand up there, identify yourself and identify the issue that you're making a stand over, and that there can't be secret holds on either judicial or political appointments.
Well, absolutely. I guess tenure there tends to breed timidity. And right now, we don't need timidity, given all the problems this country has.
So what do you think, then, is going to happen with these meetings that are taking place? I imagine Harry Reid's getting an earful. Basically, the junior guys are probably saying to him, look, you got had, and why didn't you listen to us? And maybe let's do what we proposed. Now, I guess the problem with the filibuster, and we saw the recent filibuster by Rand Paul, which garnered a lot of sympathy on the left and the right, curiously enough, he's kind of a libertarian zealot in many ways. So wouldn't that system then favor the person who's most prone to grandstand?
It may very well, but it's also, of course, for human reasons, self-limiting. It's only on as long as you manage to hold the floor.
Hold your bladder, I guess, yeah.
Precisely. I was implying that.
Right. Well, I'm a little crude, I must say.
That said, you have to talk about something when you're on the floor. And he garnered a lot of attention when he was doing that because it was so out of the way and unusual these days for a filibuster actually to be conducted in the old-fashioned way of getting up and speaking. The public paid attention to it, and he had to have something to say, something relevant to the case he was making. Whereas with these secret filibusters and secret holds, people doing them don't have to explain them, and that's precisely the point. They don't have to explain them means they get off the hook because they can't explain why they are throwing sand in the gears of the democratic process.
Well, your new book, Mike Lofgren, The Party is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted, says it all. And I know that the Republicans are crazy, and another word for crazy is determined. it's a more politer way to put it, that they get their way, even if they have these tantrums like spoiled children, they still get their way because the Democrats fold. So I'm trying to understand the psychology here, how a determined minority can roll a feckless majority, and why it is that you have this disparity with the Republicans, who essentially are doing the bidding of the billionaires and the bankers. That seems to be what they're all about. They go to the mat for the billionaires and the bankers, and the Democrats are supposed to be the champions of working Americans in the middle class, and they don't seem to stand up for the majority of the country with the same zeal that the Republicans stand up for the 1%.
I would say there's more than one reason for that. Partly, as we've discussed, it's structural. If we had a parliamentary system, as in Britain, there would be no question of this. It's the majority carries the day, and that's that. Okay, we're stuck with the Senate, but there's other reasons as well that explain Reid's and some others' hesitation before trying to abolish the filibuster or reform it. And one of them is historical. I would say after losing the 88 presidential election, the third one in a row they lost, the Democrats retooled themselves and made themselves more of a business-friendly party. And they've been very ambivalent ever since then about who they are. And if you've noticed, I think this is pretty common. A Republican office holder has no hesitation of calling himself conservative. In fact, he'll say he's more conservative than anybody else. He's more conservative than the other candidate, and on right. and on and
he's
on.
Severely conservative.
Whether or not the public at large, never mind the primary voter, but the public at large may not necessarily identify with conservative issues on an issue-for-issue basis. But he will proudly call himself a conservative. How many Democratic office holders will say they are proud liberals, including our president?
Well, I think you've hit the nail on the head there, Mike Loughran, and I thank you for joining us here today.
Well, it was good to be here.
Again, I've been speaking with Mike Loughran, who has spent 28 years working in Congress, the last 16 as a senior analyst on the House and Senate budget committees, which gave him ringside seats on TARP, Hurricane Katrina disaster relief, debates on the Pentagon budget, and the amazing antics of various deficit reduction commissions. He's the author of the new book, The Party Is Over, How Republicans Went Crazy, Democrats Became Useless, and the Middle Class Got Shafted. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.